Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikaias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. What's up, everybody? Shout out to all you dunkers. Thank you for embracing your bounce. Let's go.
There we go. And we have a guest, at least for the first portion of the show. Let me make sure I have all of this right, because our esteemed guest here is a little bit everywhere. So, words at WNBA.com right now, basketballnews.com, podcast with Andy Cornrows with the great Caitlin Cooper. Tag the Roll. Do I have that right?
Doing
some draft content as well. Mark Schindler, how are you?
I'm good. As you just implied, busy. Today's been like an insanely busy day, but we're chilling, man. I'm excited. It's 85 in Ohio. I don't know what to do with myself, so let's go.
There we go. Starting to heat up. And as such, the WNBA season is also heating up. Before I even dig into the season with you, how has the season been for you?
It's been very exciting. There was so much change in the offseason heading into this season and really trying to engross myself in all of that and get a better vibe for where every team was at, not just personnel-wise, but, you know, personality and that's been exciting. And especially with everything happening, NBA and draft at the same time has been like, you know, like, but we're here. And it's been a pretty raucous, like, first 2 weeks. So it's been, I don't really entirely know what to make of every team yet, but I have thoughts for sure.
All right. Well, then let's get into some of those thoughts. I'll start it off super general. Which team or teams have surprised you the most in the early goings of the season?
I mean, we have to start with the Atlanta Dream. Granted, they're 4-1. The four wins are against sub-500 teams right now. So, in fairness, you have to mention that. But with where this Dream team was at last year, this is incredible. Like, they started 4-2 to start the year, but the vibes were completely different. Like, this team has a very different feel to it. They're second in defense right now, and that feels tangible. Like, I don't think that they're going to be the best defense in the league, but what they're doing on a night-to-night basis is really translated, and I feel good about it. And the biggest thing is Ryan Howard. Like, she's been unreal. Like, I think she'll probably be an all-star this season, frankly. Like, I know it's five games in, so that's a big proclamation, but she's already asserted herself as one of the best in the league. It's been kind of nutty to watch.
I have been super impressed. I was in Atlanta last Friday.
Aren't you?
Check out the game against the Aces. Hey, not big time like you yet, but.
Okay, yeah.
Y'all both big time. That man was in his suite.
Oh, brother. Absolutely.
I don't know if you can be big time in Cleveland, man. I mean, maybe Larry Nash Jr. has something else to say about that, but I don't know, man.
Wow.
Yeah. Hey, you got 9 jobs and the Kai's got 9 townhouses. Y'all, it's a pick and roll duo.
Man. I can't escape this anywhere.
I'm not doing this. Steve, what about you? What team has surprised you the most so far?
I mean, the Dreamer won. The Mystics being able to hang on and show this kind of defense consistently has surprised me. I would say the Aces. I wasn't prepared for that. I'm a little surprised with some of the teams at the bottom, but I'm sure that's the next question. But it's early in the season. And the interesting part is it's early, but you can't let the season get away from you too quickly in the W. So there have been some positive things. I think the top of the table is the top of the table for a reason.
Definitely. Also, shout out Elena Deladon. Elena Deladon's defense has been just fantastic through the first 5 games. Like, her rim protection, her mobility, stuff that I wasn't really sure what to expect coming in. Like, I knew, you know what you're getting offensively from her, but she's been a huge reason for why they're looking so good defensively. So it's been awesome to see.
Let's actually dig into the Mystics a little bit. You recently had an interview with rookie center Shakira Austin. One, how was that? Two, what has impressed you the most about her start?
She's great. She's got awesome personality. I should be talking again to her soon because we're going to do some checkups throughout the year. She just had a 20-point game against the Wings. She's balling. She's looked really good. Adds a whole new dynamic to that team. I got slandered for wearing black Air Force Ones, which I feel, you know, for most people were not in my corner on that one. But a good time.
Are you good, man?
Are you good?
Black
Air Force? I'm good. Yeah. Okay. I mean, hey man, I wear them for a reason. I accepted the slander with a smile on my face, but no, man, like she's really exciting. She has some fun passing flashes. She has some real, like, especially in that Wings game, she had some ridiculous finishes off the bounce. Like, she had one, like, Tasha Cloud threw a pass was a little bit behind her, and she reached around, caught it, did like this little twirl, and finished with her offhand going away from the basket. And she's had, like, you know, like double digit finishes like that where you see the touch, like, okay, you know, I'm excited. And I mean, in talking to her too, she's working on a lot of stuff that she really wants to incorporate into her game, but she's also very cognizant of, like, you know, what the team is right now, her place on it. And I'm excited. I think she's going to add a real element to this team moving forward.
As I said, her ability to screen and roll, like the effort she gives to get up there to screen, but also it's time to roll, she's going. And the versatility she's shown on the glass, cutting, ability to operate the top of the key and function with your offense, I've been surprised by that. It's kind of jumped off. She kind of has that energy when you watch her on the floor.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, obviously not like a massive jump shooter yet, but, like, her ability to attack off like, you know, one or two dribbles off the catch really takes some bigs by surprise. Like, Sylvia Fowles had some trouble with that. Obviously, you know, she's still, so she was a lot better with it in the second half, but really caught her by surprise early in that game. And she's done that quite a few times this year.
While we're still on the Mystics, are you having as much fun watching Rui as Steve has so far this
season? She's awesome. The anti-compositives, like, one of my top five calls in podcasting this year already. And I think if I could have a podcast ESPYs, that's gonna be up there. She's been awesome, man. She hit, like, I don't remember who was defending her. It was somebody who had, like, I mean, everybody has like 5 inches on her, but I think it was Alicia Gray was defending her. And comes, like, rear, you know, like the Jrue Holiday, Eric Bledsoe closeout. And Rui just can't cash as a pull-up jumper anyways. Like, she's kind of done everything. And I love it. She's very fun to watch play. And she's effective, too. Like, defensively, like, people have tried to go at her. Like, Marina Mabry tried to really go at her. And it didn't really work. So, yeah, I'm enjoying it.
Definitely fun. You mentioned Tasha Cloud a little bit earlier. She was someone that you referenced in one of your pieces that you wrote for WNBA.com. You're talking about some of the elite playmakers in the league. One, people should check that out on the website if you haven't already. Two, was that list ranked?
It was not ranked. Full disclosure, I got asked to do a top 25 players under 25, and I mean, it was like, no, I'm not doing that. The W players are very active on Twitter, man. And I was not subjecting myself to that. So I did not rank this list. I played it safe. I hedged, as you know me, Nikias. I do not throw things out like that. So I had that was not a ranked list.
Okay. Well, then in terms of, like, preference, what type of passer do you enjoy, particularly in the W? Are you more of the high pick and roll, making reads person? Or you mentioned Candace Parker in the piece, and she's able to dice things up from above the break and then the elbows and stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm biased, man. Like, I personally, like, I won't lie, Natasha's probably my favorite passer in the league. Like, it's a little bit chaotic, but with, like, goodness. It's like eating spicy curry for the first time. Like, if you go over to your friend's house, you've never had curry before, like me growing up in Ohio. First time I ever had curry was an experience. Like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. I don't know what to make of it. And that's how I feel like watching somebody like Natasha Cloud, who uses every square inch of the court. Like, I love that. I love ball handlers who, you know, contort their body, or they try and make, you know, the most audacious passes with efficacy, of course. Like, there has to be, like, some kind of reined in-ness to it. But definitely my favorite player to watch handle the ball. And Sloot, too. I mean, like, come on. Like, the Sky, I'm sure we'll talk about them in a minute. But, like, they have, like, you know, shoot, like, 3 of the 15 best passers in the league on their team. So, like, it, yeah. Kind of unfair, but yeah.
Also, just, and because they have that kind of blend of playmaking and just the general scoring a bit in the team, like, they are one of the most diverse half court teams in the W as well. So they are a joy to watch when they get humming. Actually, I'll flip the question to you, Steve, before we move forward. Who are some of your favorite passers in the W?
Sue Bird.
Of course.
Without saying, but now I'm glad you asked if it was ranked, because I was a little concerned when I was reading that article. I did not see Sue Bird on there, but we're good. Cordy Vandersloot's ability to create and make plays and punish any coverage has always been a joy for me to watch personally. I'm always a sucker for bigs who can create. I'm not going to do the Dolson thing here, but I'm just going to mention it.
I mean, hey, man, I have some Dolson things to say, too, with how this year's going. But that's...
All right, so...
I'm canceled, I know.
No, that's fine. But no, it's been good stuff. I'm intrigued by what Kelsey Plum's doing. Just going to leave that there. But I like guards play. I like guards driving, kicking, making plays, making reads against different coverages. That's always the fun part of the W for me.
It's fun. Like, I feel like the... I don't know if dichotomy is the right word, but I feel like it's a little bit different from the NBA, where it's like the rise of the big wing creator has kind of been a thing. You have your LeBrons, you have your Lucas, just those big playmaking wings. Like in the W, it doesn't feel like there are the playmaking wings that are making those kind of reads as much. It feels like it's very much guard heavy, or you have your high post initiators. Do you feel like there's going to be some sort of shift at some point?
That's going to be really interesting, especially too. I dipped a little bit into some college basketball. Like, it really feels like a lot more about guards coming up. Like, there's this girl at Texas right now, Rory Harmon. She's going to be amazing. She's so good already. Like, one of the craziest paint touch athletes I've ever seen. She's going to be phenomenal. But, like, yeah, I think so much of it is predicated on ball handlers and being able to collapse defense, especially, too, with, like, how good a dominant post player can be and impact things. Like, I mean, just watching Candace, man. Like, Candace is in, what, like, this is year 15 for her? Mm-hmm. And she's still, like, pretty easily one of the 10 best players in the league, in my opinion. And seeing what she can do with her feel, her court vision, her athleticism still, I think a lot of it still is going to be predicated on guard play.
The evolution is going to be fun, but I think just with how much movement there is in the game, it usually ends up back in the guard's hands against a scrambling defense, more so than just one person creating consistently. Mm-hmm. So I think there will be a shift eventually, but I think just the way the ball moves makes it a lot easier to get it back to your guard. Now they drive a closeout. Now you play out of that or something like that.
Definitely. Also, one thing to hit on too was just evolution in general, because this is stuck. Like, I tweeted this out probably about a week ago. Pace is up like demonstrably. Like, I don't remember who had the highest pace last year. I think it was the Liberty. And the Liberty would rank like ninth this year in pace from last year. So pace is way up, and I think that's something that's going to stay for sure.
Yeah, I got you. We talked about some of the surprising teams at the top. Who are some teams that have kind of disappointed early in the season for you?
I think it's hard to not say Minnesota, but also it's tough because they got dealt a really difficult hand. You know, I think you can bring up, you know, how much of that was on them is a fair question to ask, but injuries suck. The Liberty, yeah. That has been very disappointing, especially with how their game looked early in the year against the Connecticut, especially against Connecticut. I was like, okay, like, we're here now. I still think there are some good things happening, but there's just a lot going on with the roster. Now, Jocelyn Willoughby, who was starting at the three, is going to be out for a month and a half. I mean, they're phasing in completely new schemes, new coach, so I want to give them some leeway, but also I think they were very much a team this year where, like, it's kind of like looking at the Hawks in the NBA. Like, this is not a team that was supposed to be taking a step back. It's a team that you want to see taking those next steps forward. I still think they're on that path, but this is not the start they wanted for sure.
No, we can talk about it. We can talk about it. It's fine. It's fine. It's still Liberty season, but it's not. It's been tough so far. I think to your point, there was elements where, hey, they have the pieces and now they have the coaching and it should gel together. I'm not saying it's not, but the issue is, you have teams treating Sabrina in a completely different fashion. Like, hey, man, we're hedging everything. Yeah. And if we don't,
yeah. Candace Parker, oh my God, man.
Yeah. Candace Parker got after her, and then other teams, they're mixing coverages. So that's not an automatic. Natasha Howard hasn't been able to punish her portion of the deal, which is tough. Laney's been good, but those are your three that have to score. And the shooting really hasn't been there from those three. Like, Natasha Howard shoot 32%. It doesn't really work if that's how it's going to go. And the defense hasn't been there, which they needed to at least get to a decent level. Like, the activity is there, but they're still just giving up points left and right. Add in some turnovers, and you're basically just hoping Hanzu comes in and gets buckets 6 minutes at a time.
Yeah. Some turnovers is generous. Like, franchise record turnovers in this last game against the Sun. I would not want to play against an a motivated Alyssa Thomas. That just seems like the worst thing of all time. She's so good. I mean, exactly like you're saying. I don't think it's all on Steph, but I think, you know, seeing how they're still trying to integrate her in has been interesting, because I don't think, like, I think for me with watching Steph play, like, I don't want to say she's being, I mean, obviously not that she's being utilized incorrectly. That's the wrong way to put it. But like, I think for this team that wants to be so high pace, I don't want to say that her fit doesn't make sense, but it has felt funky and awkward at times. And again, 5 games in, so I don't want to be unfair, but it'll be interesting to see how they figure that out, especially too, like, even on the wing, like Beck Allen's going to be back now. She just played in the last game after, like, she barely even practiced. I think she mentioned she was like, you know, Jackie Powell from Bleacher Report interviewed her and was like, just look at my eyes. Like, you can tell I'm straight up jet lagged right now. Like, just getting off the flight. And look, she still played a good game. She didn't shoot well, but like, you saw the impact immediately of having someone like that. But I just feel like they're almost running themselves too hard right now. Like, I want to see them slow things down, because they just are going way too fast for their own good. It's going to be really interesting to see how they balance things out.
This man just came on with Dolson slander.
It's not slander. It's not working right now.
Man, what are we going to talk about? The Mercury? What's up?
We got to talk about the Sparks. Like,
well, I mean, those are my two teams on the list. So go ahead, Nikias, clear out. Let's go fishing.
I will say, like, the offense has not been what I've expected it to be. They are trying to work in some new pieces, and so that's part of it. I do think there's just a general lack of shooting that kind of restricts things, on top of them trying to work in these new pieces. So it isn't as smooth as I just haven't liked the flow in the half court. And if they aren't able to get efficient looks in the half court, then it kind of bleeds into the defense, and then we're just kind of spinning in circles. That's all. I'm going to leave it there. Mark, what are your takeaways for the Sparks right now?
Yeah, I don't want to get like too doom and gloom, but I do think, like you mentioned, the flow has been really tough. Like, finding, I don't like just saying disappointment, but like, Kennedy Carter has not fit very well at all yet. And I think that's something, I'm high on her still figuring things out. She's extremely talented. She's extremely good, but like, so very clearly on a different pace than the rest of the team. Like, especially, like, I thought that first game was super indicative. You saw, like, she wants to push the pace. She wants to push the tempo. And like, they're about average in pace right now, but it's more so like what you're seeing with that starting lineup, especially. I mean, shout out to Jordan Cannon. Jordan Cannon has been awesome. Like, yes, even if the shot hasn't been like as crisp as, like, you know, since the first two games. But the issue is, you just have so many guards who are best with the ball in their hands and attacking. And then you have like a lot of bigs who operate best out of the post. Like, Nneka is awesome, but like, again, if you're just spacing her out to three, that's not entirely getting all of the seasoning sauce, whatever you want to call it. Like, I just think that finding where they're at with, because this is a team that's very much going to have to grind out with set plays, in my opinion. Like, with considering what their spacing is right now, they're really going to have to figure some things out set wise. And it just hasn't been there right now. Like, obviously, Katie Lou Samuelson just came in. I think she'll be, like, she's going to be a huge part of what their success is or isn't. Like, you know, how can she factor in? Like, I'd imagine she starts at some point, just given what she brings. Like, shout out Lexi Brown too. Like, she's been, I think other than Lexi, only one player is shooting above league average from three right now. And Lexi's shooting like 63% from three. So she has been their perimeter shooting. But I mean, we can have the Liz talk, but I think as much as like, it can come down to that, like, just finding wings or anything to connect on this team is going to be important. Like, I like some of Ray Burrell's minutes and what she brings, but it seems like she's out of the rotation already. Part of that is injury, but she was already starting to get less minutes. She wasn't hitting her shots, but like, you could just see, even with her being a rookie, you'd see like, oh, having somebody out there who is not a guard and who is not a big and who can move with players who are wing size is like, whoa, that does stuff on both ends. So I think Katie Lou is going to be important for that, but I have a lot of questions.
My big thing with the Sparks is they have a lot of talent. We talked about this before the season. How is it going to look offensively? And you mentioned the need for sets. I'm looking for the flow, because it feels like very, okay, we're going to run elbow and go to a handoff. sweet. And then we're going to go elbow and pin down for Liz. Cool. Then we're going to run a post up for NECA. Okay. What do you do outside of the sets?
Yeah.
You have the talent. You have pressure points, but it feels like it's very your turn, my turn-ish. Not even in a bad way, but it just doesn't feel like any of the pieces are connecting. That's why I kind of want to see what Katie Lou looks like out there, because I think they can put pressure on teams, but they've got to find the flow and rhythm as far as what they want to run. If they're just going to be half court, slow tempo, despite the talent, it's going to have a ceiling.
Yeah. Maybe I'm being unfair in that way, because I almost feel like, not that their talent can't do it, but I just don't know where the flow is going to come from. Is maybe that, I don't know, maybe that's unfair, but I just, like, especially watching them the first couple games, it's been very sloggy. Is that a word? An adjective? I know slog is a word, but sloggy, probably not.
Hashtag is big slog, folks.
Folks, we've done it. I guess we got to end on the Liz Cambage conversation. For me, it's not going to be.
That's what Liz is doing. Yeah.
There we go. That's a good shot. But no, with Liz,
I'm going too far.
When she's playing the fever. But no, on a serious note, the fit has just been weird. And I think when you have the kind of versatile front court pieces that the Sparks have, throwing Liz into the mix, it's just going to be an adjustment period. It's too early to say it's not going to work, but it has been a bit of an adjustment period, particularly offensively. Because she does do good things on offense, particularly in the post. She still warrants a double team. When she does her homework early, gets those deep seals, there isn't anything you can really do with her with that kind of size. But defensively, it's just kind of where it falls apart for me. She's not scheme versatile at all. Very deep drop. The activity just hasn't been there for much of the season. And it just gives teams built-in shots, basically. They hunt her. And that's a bit problematic for the Sparks.
Well, I do think, to be fair, too, it's tough because, overall, I don't love where their defense is at. They have a lot to figure out team-wise. I think I'm more worried about, where the communication is at right now than necessarily just Liz. I'm definitely there with you. I think, she's pretty one-dimensional, but that one dimension can be good if you figure some things out. Right now, it's not that their point of attack defense has been bad. I think they've been really rough after the first action happens. Same thing with the offense. So after the first action happens, what is happening with the rest of stuff? How are you shutting down secondary things? What is your scramble? What is your flow? And to be fair, Liz does play a big part in what that secondary flow can look like defensively, but they just haven't really been in tune on that side yet to the level where they should be, in my opinion. This team is too athletic and especially if you have both Shanae and NECA out there, that's a lot of size. It's a lot of length. That's a lot of mobility. We know who NECA is when she's at her best. Jordan Canada is she's nutty at the point of attack when she's locked in. But I think it's going to be finding some of that communication because it hasn't really been there yet.
I think that's all fair. Actually, Mark, before we get you out of here, a quick NBA question for you, since you do plenty of work on that side as well. The all rookie teams were announced.
We ain't got enough time for this, man. We don't have enough time for this. We're not. Come on, man. Come on, man. It's been 36 hours since this was released. We don't even have the names of this. Come on, man. Let it go. All right. Go ahead, man.
I just want to get your
thoughts. This is ridiculous.
Just want to get your thoughts on the teams, and then I'll let you plug all your things.
I personally cannot see a way to leave Herb Jones off the first team, but they didn't ask me, man. I love Jalen Green. I can't get there. I thought he had a fantastic year, but just given, even if you're just including games missed, had a rough start, as rookies do. That's in fairness. I did argue people yesterday, but I won't argue now. I think Herb was just too good this year, man. You and I both had him all defense. I think that he should be all defense. Dear God, please just announce the teams. When are we going to get the damn teams? But I don't know, man. I can't watch what Herb Jones did night in, night out and say that he wasn't first team all rookie.
The hashtag is it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. 2019, 2020, Tyler Hero, second team. First team, Eric Pascal. 2018, 2019, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, second team. First team, Marvin Bagley, the third.
The hashtag is big points.
What year is this? 2016, 17, Brandon Ingram, second team. Willie Hernan Gomez, first team.
Hey, that was on it was like Melo's last next year, right?
15, 16, Miles, Emmanuel Mudiay, second team. What? D'Angelo Russell, second team, first team, Jahlil Okafor. 2014, 2015, Elfrid Payton, first team, second team, Marcus Smart. What are we doing?
I'm just saying, what if we set a new precedent, you know? But it's okay.
What did The Rock used to say?
Can you smell
it? It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
There's the wrestling shot. I will save my thoughts for later. Mark, where can the people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at @MG_Schindler. My work is, as Nikias mentioned, is kind of all over the place. So I recommend following me on Twitter. I'm very active there, for better or worse. I appreciate you guys having me on. I always enjoy listening to you guys. So it was a thrill to be on.
Hey, thank you, Mark. But that energy was for Nikias, not you.
Okay, good. I had to make sure. I felt like I was getting scolded by my dad for a second. So,
we're gonna bounce back on this. It's fine. But please follow Mark. His work is tremendous. He's also doing a lot of fun stuff for the W. And we need more W coverage. We need more smart W coverage. So thank you for doing your part to bring it. Thank you for coming on, sir.
Thanks for having me.
I'll start here. The all-rookie teams were announced. Can go over those very quickly. Cade Cunningham, Franz Wagner, Scotty Barnes, Evan Mobley, Jalen Green made the first team. Second team was Ayo Dosunmu, Bones Highland, Chris Duarte, Herb Jones, and Josh Giddey. So, we had our awards episode towards the end of the regular season. I released my fictitious ballot. I had a Herb Jones on the first team. I do not agree with Jalen Green over Herb Jones on the first team. I think Herb had a more consistent season. I think the defensive impact that he had was pretty darn dope. Don't want to discount the circumstances that Jalen Green went through, particularly in the first half of the season. We talked about some of the Rockets' early struggles, especially when some of the smoke about Stephen Smiles was coming out. So he wasn't in the best context early, and he lit it up in the particularly in 2022 in the second half of the season. So I don't think Jalen Green is bad. I think he will be one of the best players from this class. Whatever. What really bugged me when the voting came out, one, again, Herb not making first team. Herb not being on 9 ballots. What is the case for Herb Jones not being a top 10 rookie this season? What is the basketball argument for Herb Jones not being a top 10 rookie? I need that explained. You can give me the Jalen over Herb case. I'll disagree ultimately, but at least there is one. Who are the 10 rookies that were better than Herb Jones this year? And I tweeted out, like, basically asked, like, what sport is being watched if Herb Jones wasn't a top 10 rookie? Because it's not basketball. You can't watch that guy have that kind of defensive impact and still fill gaps on the offensive end and not have him on your ballot. It's absurd. It is absurd. That is my rant. That's all I got. We got to do better. Voting block has to be good. Like, that can't happen.
This one, Davion.
And who else?
Maybe this did.
10 guys?
Out of how many?
I can't even fathom what the 10. Again, like, I had Herb on my first team, so I don't think there were 5. But 10?
Out of how many?
What do you mean?
Out of how many voters? 10 out of how many voters?
No, wait, no, I'm saying, like, No, it was 100 votes, 100 ballots. And 9 people didn't have him on the ballot, period.
So we're mad because he wasn't unanimously selected? I'm confused.
Yeah, that's like, yeah. Because I don't get how that happens.
In 2001, 2002, Joe Johnson and Vladimir Radonovich were tied on the second team.
Okay.
Chris Mim was an all-rookie second team player.
Okay.
Why is it grind your gears so much, man?
It's the principle. Like, I just want the voters. Like, I don't want to get super riled up. We are recording this portion of the podcast later than usual. So I don't want to turn it into like a 20-minute thing, but like, Herb Jones was very good this season. And for that to not be universally recognized, again, you can quibble over first team or second team, but like, I just don't see how you could come to a case where no, 10 dudes were better than him in his rookie class. I don't see it.
I don't think it's 10. So let's break it down. Let's give a little pushback here.
Okay.
Just for giggles, right? So the big three, Scotty, Cade, Evan, unanimous.
Yes.
All received all first team votes, which means we're splitting hairs for the last two. Franz got a lot of love. Jalen Green also. They're in. That's 5, right?
Okay.
Giddey got 74 second team votes. He's in. Io got 71. He's in. Bones got 81. That changes the math. That's 8, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you have the people that put Herb first team, the people who put him second team. A lot of Jonathan Kuminga. I'm saying that's where the votes went. I'm literally looking at the votes.
No, I'm not saying that you're not.
I'm just saying. So if you're saying we're looking Giddey, Bones, Io, we're on the majority of the second team balance, and someone wants to go Kuminga, there's one vote left. And if they value offense more than they put Chris Duarte, guess who doesn't get a vote?
Then what's the case for Kuminga over?
So for 10 people, they may have thought, I like Kuminga's versatility and his potential, and I like Duarte's offense. What if these 10 people have seen more Warriors games than Pelicans games? I'm asking. I personally don't subscribe to groupthink.
That's fine. Like, I don't think it should be group. Like,
you gotta remember, Sengun got 13 second place votes. Jalen Suggs got votes. Jose Alvarado got votes. Austin Reeves got votes. Cam Thomas got a vote. Trey Murphy got a vote.
Why did Trey Murphy get a
vote? This is how you end up with 10 people not voting for Herb Jones. I'm trying to help you out.
Yes, and that's not how that should work.
But that's why the point system is in place.
Oh, my head's going to hurt.
Why is it going to hurt? He finished 25 points behind Jalen Green. He was the leader on the second team. What's the problem?
I just watching Kuminga and watching Herb Jones this year. Kuminga over Herb Jones this season is just
1998-99. Matt Harpring was voted first team over Anton Jameson and Katino Mobley.
Probably not great in hindsight. But even then, like, I wasn't 98-99. I was 4 turning 5.
Matt Maloney was a second team all rookie player.
Don't know who that is.
You don't know who Matt Maloney is?
I do not know who Matt Maloney is.
Jeez, cheese and rice. What am I going to do with you?
throw me over the top rope, probably.
Joe Smith was voted over Kevin Garnett. Just throwing these things also, out here that no one remembers. It's okay.
If a bad vote happens in the forest and no one is around to hear it, did the vote happen.
But the key is no one's going to remember it. No one's going to remember it.
It's the principal.
Again, I ask, principals in 2022, where we have Bob Cousy clapping back at J.J. Redick and John Stockton writing letters and all sorts of... You want principals? That's what you want?
The absence of principals elsewhere does not...
This is what you want? This is where we're starting with this podcast?
Look, I just want it to... I just want it to be better. That's all. That's all. That's all. I do not think... To be clear, I do not think the voter should have had my exact ballot.
I'm just saying, Darius Garland got a total of 14 votes when it was his turn as a rookie.
He was not a good rookie, though.
I'm just saying.
I'm not treating it as a career projection. Like, I think Jalen Green is going to be better than Herb Jones long term. Like, that's not the argument I'm making. But if we were rewarding what happened during the regular season, again, I think he had a better regular season than Jalen. Like, it's fine for people to disagree with that. I just don't, from watching this rookie class and doing rookie reports with you, and I don't see how 10 play in the rookie teams, as you've noted before, like, they're positionless. So you can't even say, like, oh, I just thought there were 4 guards better. It's literally just pick the best 10 rookies. Herb is 11 for some people. It's fine, though. Votes are in. Congrats to all the rookies that made the team.
But you make the assumption that everyone, A, has the same brain, sees basketball the same way, and watches games, or they just value it. Just because they have a vote.
I would hope that at the very least, watching the game should be a prerequisite for having votes.
We put too much stock into people's resumes and not enough into who they are. That's why y'all fall for the anonymous scout of pump fake every time.
It's fine. All right. Well, shout out to the anonymous scouts out there. And shout out to, again, the rookies that made the teams, all 10 of you. And there we go. We did it. We made it through. I am not mad.
You're welcome. I gotta get packed up tomorrow because I'm trying to get you off a ledge.
What are you getting packed up for?
Contrarian.
I appreciate the opposite perspective. It's fine.
We can let it go now, though, right?
Debatable. To this the is playoffs. 7.
All right, man. All right.
No, it's going to be fine until the next set of awards are released, and then we'll see what happened there. But at any rate, let's get into some playoffs.
Where was this energy when John Morant was named most improved player? That's all I want to know.
At least he improved a bunch.
All right, Miami, Boston, what happened?
Well, in game one, the Heat won by 11, sparked by a ridiculous third quarter, sparked by a 27-point second half, 41-point game by Jimmy Butler. Great first half for Jason Tatum, not so great in the second half. And then game two happened. Al Horford and Marcus Smart were both out. Horford was in health and safety protocols. Marcus Smart was dealing with a foot sprain. They both came back for game two, and Miami started the game off hot, jumped out to an 18-8 lead, and promptly fell apart / had their waters turned off from there. So, Steve, I'll just flip it to you. Very general question. I guess, like, what is your feel for the series right now?
What is my feel for the series? It's 1-1, and it's still a mirror series. I borrowed from my guy, Cooper Moorhead, best in the world, and he talked about the feedback loop. Mm-hmm. And this is a series where that really exists, where whichever team imposes their will is going to take it. The big thing in game one
was Boston had good process offensively in the first half. They were able to find the gaps. They were able to attack Miami's spacing or use their spacing to attack Miami's help defense, create quality looks. It felt like a combination of what they had seen in the Brooklyn series and the Milwaukee series preparing them for this. And then Miami flipped an absolute switch, doubled down on the help, forced turnovers, active, multiple efforts, contained dribble penetration, late help, and they flipped that game on its head. We fast forward to what happened here in game two, where Boston took a punch and came back offensively with better offensive process. And they got the results. And Miami was taking the ball out of the net. So the transition wasn't the same. Now they're in the half court, just like Boston was. And whichever team can find their way offensively is going to give themselves a chance because of how good these defensive are. In two games, we've seen two incredible defensive performances that resulted in blowouts. So people are probably just going to go, who cares? It's me.
First thing they care.
Mayor of Dweebtown.
Patron of Dweebtown.
No, I mean, it's incredible to watch these teams kind of go back and forth. And the feel is, how much do we put into which team has done what they're supposed to do defensively and which team hasn't done what they're supposed to do offensively? That's my question. So when it comes to a feel for the series, we've seen what both sides can do to win. Who's going to be able to do it more? Mm-hmm. What's your feel on the series so far?
For me, it's kind of been about Boston for me in both games. It's been more Boston for me. And I've kind of been watching, you talked about Boston's process offensively. I've been kind of keyed into what their process is defensively. Because in game one, they were able to jump out to, what was it, a 62-54 lead in the first half of that game. And their offense was humming a bit. Defensively, Miami had a lot of pockets to attack. It was a lot of drop coverage for Boston, which was odd for me because this is an incredibly switchy group, not just a switchy group, the switchiest team in basketball during the regular season. And that's held firm in the postseason as well. And so watching them in drop in the first half of that game was a curious choice to me.
If only you had a podcast.
If only. Yeah. We'll see. Have to search Apple, Spotify, Google.
I just be talking on here, dog. I don't know. You just be surprised by things I be talking about. Anyways, continue.
No, I was just like, this is interesting that they're going to this consistently. Rob Williams in a drop. All right, cool. Grant Williams in a drop. Why? Which is odd. And so Boston jumps out to the first half lead, and I posted a stat, like Miami had a 105 offensive rating in the half court in the first half. And I'm just like, okay, my question for Miami is, if can they score? And if they're doing that with as sloppy as they were, particularly in the second quarter defensively, if they can tighten that up, they have a pathway. I wasn't expecting them to jump out to a 22-2 run to kick off the third quarter. Was maybe not that kind of switch being flipped. That's a testament to what they were able to do. Jimmy Butler was incredible. The ball pressure was great. Bam Adebayo making ridiculous efforts all over the court. And they were able to do that. So I'm just like, okay, now Miami has the defense running and they also have, they found some pressure points. And for Boston, it felt like they were kind of giving Miami some.
Boston's defense, they didn't have a choice in game one. In game two, there were no pressure points to be had.
That's true. True in the sense that, like, obviously not having Marcus Smart and Al Horford is a hit. But, like, I don't know if Horford's absence, Smart's absence, is why you go Grant Williams in a drop. Like, I think that could have been a switch either way.
But Grant Williams in a drop wasn't the game decider. It was Peyton Pritchard existing.
No, it wasn't the game decider. But I'm looking at the whole thing.
But Grant Williams was in a dropping game too at times.
At times, and then that went away. Like, especially in the, like, towards the end of the first and heading into the second, like, the switching perked up for Boston.
Yeah, the switching perked up, but it was the multiple coverage they threw, a la Miami, in game one. That's where the fun happened for Boston defensively in this game, too. Because in game one, Miami was incredible as far as once they found the nuance of, hey, we're not going to make everything an automatic switch. Some of the stuff's going to be an under. Some of it's going to be a switch. Some of it's going to be two on the ball. We're going to rotate, recover. Mm-hmm. That caused chaos. Boston gave them a dose of their own medicine. When they went to that smaller lineup with Horford at the five, every handoff, switch. Ball's in front. You're not going anywhere. Now Tyler Hero comes off. Guess what? Trap. Mm-hmm. Started the game with Horford and Williams. Both playing what?
Both in a drop.
Both in a drop. And drop hasn't been Miami's friend. That's why I mentioned the importance of the guard play to try and make Boston pay. Mm. But we're going to stay in a drop. We're going to sell on the roll. And if we're in trouble, Robert Williams is going to come help. That's where the blend comes for me. Mm-hmm. And so Boston having that defensive lineup and being able to have an impact defensively while they have two bigs, and then flow right into that lineup where you really don't have anyone you can attack. And if you look at that game, the big concern for me in game two for Miami was they are searching offensively right now. Mm-hmm. They can't find the pressure point. It's a lot of pick and roll, which is great against Philadelphia and their fives and drop. Against Boston, who is just switching or in a drop, throwing you different coverages, you're not getting a lot out of it. Empty corner, empty side, pick and roll was Miami's bread and butter. You know what Boston did in game two?
Switched it.
Horford in a drop. Marcus Smart going under. Whole first half. Eventually threw in a couple switches in there, but they took that off the tape. They did little things like flipping matchups. Hey, we'll put Robert Williams on Oladipo. We'll put Smart on Deadman if he's in the game. So guess what? Deadman comes to the screen, it's a switch. You want to flow into a handoff trying to attack Williams? Guess what that is? Switch. And then you keep going and we get to the matchup we actually want. It's Marcus Smart on Jimmy Butler somehow. So to me, it's... I Miami hit the right notes against that Boston team in game one because they were presented to him. In game two, the offensive process wasn't there. Tempo wasn't there. The ball movement was kind of there, wishy-washy, but they couldn't get the dribble penetration. They couldn't get the ball in the paint. They couldn't force Boston to have to help. Not that Boston didn't help or they wouldn't help. That's a principle of theirs. But they couldn't put that pressure on them. If you go back to the Sixers series, when Miami got in the mud, they were able to get out of it by just driving. And that helped balance out everything else they were doing. They couldn't get past anyone in Boston tonight in game two. That's interesting. But continue on.
No, and the dribble penetration point is a good one. That's something that M.A. Udoka spoke about post-game. He said, like, one, they felt like they were much more physical in game two than they were in game one. And also, just keeping a body in front was incredibly important for them. Did keep them out of rotation. And to that point, Miami couldn't get downhill, couldn't get a lot of shots at the rim. They couldn't get Boston in rotation, so they couldn't create any or many clean threes. Boston outshot them in terms of efficiency and also outbombed them for three in terms of volume, mostly because most of the threes for Miami were coming late in the clock because they didn't have anything else. There wasn't any real flow there, and that's a testament to what Boston was able to do. And ball pressure was better, containment was better. They were able to flatten out Miami a little bit better. And so now, heading into game three, I'm just kind of like, all right, they did spend most of game two searching for a matchup to attack. The game got away from them, obviously, but do you feel like they are any closer to figuring out, like, okay, this is the guy? Like, is it going to be Jaylen Brown in the starting unit, for example?
I think they found a rhythm as far as just getting Jimmy to the ball, clearing out, and seeing what would happen, playing out of that. The key is going to be what actions can they run and how can they get Boston out of being so convinced or convicted defensively, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to say it was purposeless from Miami, but it just never felt like they got to their flow that they want to get to. You know, driving kick. How many times was it a driving kick to PJ Tucker? And how many times was Boston like, hey, you just do whatever you want? Mm-hmm. Can you flip that and now turn that into a handoff for someone to come off and shoot or another drive? You know, just like Boston had to make the adjustments after game one, when Miami said, nope, we're going to double down on this help. We're going to be everywhere. We're going to fly around. And you saw in this game too, Boston did a better job of, okay, we know you're going to help. So we know the pass is going to be there. We're going to play out of it. Can Miami flip that switch? Their offensive process is very important because ultimately it's going to be a defensive slugfest either way. Mm-hmm. But if their offensive process can't be where it needs to be, then they're going to be in trouble because that's the formula to beat this Miami team. We've seen it in the playoffs. Atlanta and Philly couldn't get all the way there. But if you can get them in the mud, you got to punch your shot. This Boston team can keep you in the mud with the bonus of we can just also hit shots. So that's what, that for me is my takeaway. Like Boston made a ton of looks. They made Miami pay what felt like almost every time. What was more important for me outside of Boston being able to create those looks and process-wise finding them was Miami just not being able to do the same thing on the other end.
I got you. So,
Yeah, I told you I'm here today. I'm here. I'm here.
A classic pod. But no, I definitely hear you. I guess I just want to see like where Miami goes. Because so we've touched on the scheme stuff, the matchup stuff, and the way they were putting smaller guys on the bigs, particularly when they went to the bench unit. That kind of has to be the second way for Miami. At least in theory, that's what it is. You want Hero to kind of come in and either add to your lead or erase the deficit. And if he doesn't have anything obvious to attack, and you're able to stifle him, it's kind of like, where do you go? So I'm intrigued by they did toss, and game was out of hand in the second half. They did toss Duncan Robinson out there. I wonder if they're going to go to him in game three at all during the important portions of the game or not. I'm curious to see what that looks like. I'm still trying to get a gauge on like what Victor Oladipo's role is on this team offensively. Because again, in game one, he did see some drops. He was able to get into some of those mid-range pull-ups, and that helped. And with Boston scrambling a little bit more on defense, he was able to attack some closeouts and get downhill. They pretty much erased all of that in game two. And if he can't find anything on ball, off the ball, Boston is going to help off of him. You mentioned their principal defensively still providing help, and he's an easy help point for them. So I want to see if Miami is able to thread some sort of needle there offensively with that second unit. What did you see with Boston's offense?
I mean, there's a few things I saw with their offense. I'll start with this. Number one, Dwayne Dedmon, aggressive pick and roll coverage versus Jaylen Brown, probably not the best idea. That just opened up an automatic for Boston. Mm-hmm. And while, yes, they made the shots, they made them pay. That's a lot of rotations maybe you didn't have to make. Get it against Tatum. But if you're going to allow Brown to also be a scorer and a playmaker on top of Tatum, you've opened up a wormhole. And Dwayne Dedmon and his quote-unquote blitzes really opened some gates up for Miami. But I liked I thought the impact of Marcus Smart being back was about what I expected offensively. He made some shots. I mean, ridiculous amount of shots.
Poor Max Roos.
To the point where, well, if we're going to go there, it's very rare you see someone make someone fall and then they do another dribble move as the guy's falling. That's another story for a different day. I mean, if Marcus Smart's going to be on his own space in the corner, making you pay for helping off of him in pick and roll. We can talk X's and O's all day. That's a different story. But I thought him being able to take some of the on-ball reps from Tatum and Brown was big for Boston. I thought his paint touches, just like in the Milwaukee series, was big for Boston. So if you know Miami's helping and Marcus Smart can force some help or version of it, guess who those kicks are going to?
Stars.
And they are either getting shots or they are attacking a scrambling defense, which is a lot different than them having to create that. And now you, instead of only being able to generate the miss message in either Tatum off the ball, a screen, or Tatum handling it, guess who can be a screener?
Tatum can.
Jason Tatum. And he can set a low screen because Miami actually kind of shifted to where they were okay with Gabe Vincent switching on to Robert Williams or Al Horford. There was one switch they weren't going to do. That was Jason Tatum. And that was a pressure point there. But I thought overall, Boston just had a better process, a better feel. They used their spacing to their advantage. I liked how they mixed cuts in versus Miami's pressure, Miami's help. I liked that they just seemed like they had more of a focus. I don't know how much of that is Horford just helping balance out some of the spacing and not having the moments where in the second half, it just felt like you had non-shooters in spots where shooters were in the first half. But they just felt like they played with a lot more purpose offensively. And they made a heck of a lot of shots.
Yeah, got you. On the Deadman front, one, I agree with you. Like, the traps were not very good, not very effective. It was wild watching him come up as high as he did. Like, it's not a new thing for Miami. But watching him go to the trap, even he forced the ball handler out, like, it was less the pressure and more so what he was doing after that. It was trap, ball gets moved, and then he's just in no man's land trying to find somebody and then forcing Miami to kind of scramble beyond that to kind of get matched up and get him somewhere where he's comfortable. And giving Boston that much to work with just led to a bunch of easy looks. So on the Deadman front, is there a role for him? Do you put him in a drop in game three, or do you just say, okay, he can't play depending on what PJ Tucker's health is, he's your backup five. You kind of split the rotation that way.
No, I mean, I don't think you have to go to PJ at the five right away. Keep it in your back pocket, but I think he gets another run. Try and put in some drop, give him some activity, maybe start the level, drop back. Just not whatever happened in game two.
Fair enough. I'm trying to think what else. You did mention like Gabe Vincent getting switched onto some of the bigs for Boston, particularly Al Horford. Like, were you surprised that they didn't try to pummel that particular matchup? Or were you okay with them just kind of passing that off and attacking elsewhere?
I mean, I was surprised they never mixed it in because we've seen them do that before, especially with Horford. But I didn't think it was a scenario where they bogged down. They just kind of went and kept flowing, which, I mean, if that's going to be what you're getting to, that's not a problem. Now, if you're just backing out and just taking all the one dribble or two dribble pull-ups, then maybe your process isn't the best, but no. But no, I mean, no, I'm all over the place, but I still go back to Boston defense. Mm. They did what they were supposed to do. And I thought Marcus Smart being able to go under versus Jimmy and them stay in the drop was big. Like, just the help mindset they had, they just never let Miami get comfortable. They never really let him get in the paint. They never really opened up some of the looks for those guys. And on the other end, they hit the pressure points. Vincent, come here. Struce, come here. Tyler Hero, come here. While Miami was just searching. And it's like you never knew exactly what Boston was going to do. Because, yeah, they did a lot of switching. But there's also a lot of late switches, drops, attacks, closeouts, recovers. Just team defense. And that goes back to my point about, hey, whoever can impose their will defensively is going to give themselves a heck of a shot.
That's a good point. I don't have anything else on Miami-Boston. Are you good to go?
I'm never good to go.
All right.
I'm never good to go, man. But no, I the ball movement from Boston's smaller lineup, the spacing there against Miami's rotations, that's interesting. The zone, I was a little surprised it came out in the third quarter. I figured that would just be a let's bust it out for game three. You got to deal with it type deal. And I was like, it kind of sparked a little bit of a run. It's going to be interesting to see how and when they use it in this series just because of Boston. Boston had a comfort moving that ball in game two. They weren't shy about trying to move it. But yeah. The other problem for Miami is you really can't afford for Jimmy Butler to have a bad game. Like, I'm sure a lot of talks we put on Marcus Smart's effort against Jimmy Butler. Man still went 11 for 18 for 29.
Mm-hmm. Who else?
Someone else has to join the party.
And I guess from there, I guess I'll ask this last one before we move to Warriors Mavericks. How, if you're Eric Spoelstra in the crew, how do you get Bam out of bio free for some offensive looks? Or is this just not the series for him, like offensive?
It can be. I think he's going to have to shift into attack mode on some of those post-movement plays. Probably try and get some more slips in if Boston's going to continue to show these switches. Try and see if maybe he can get some switches against Tatum or Brown and get some post-ups that way. There's just got to be more of a mindset to get him in spots because we know Bam is a, I won't say holistic player, but we know he's going to try and make the right play. I think it's you're going to have to scheme some things up to get him in the position to know, hey, this is your time to attack. Go ahead and get it.
All right. It's going to behoove Miami to get him going. I think he's going to have to make an impact at the score. We talked about this a little bit on the Reddit pod. Like, I feel like in theory, like Bam should have some building mismatches there, depending on how Miami schemes him up and just depending on who's guarding him. But they're going to have to find him. It didn't matter much in game one, but game two, you kind of felt it. Like, even with Jimmy Butler doing all he could offensively, no one else could really get to the rim. No one else could really put pressure on Boston's defense. So it'd be nice to see Bam get a little bit more active in game three. Like, I don't think he's the reason they lost or anything like that, but Miami's got to find something for him. Let's move. Oh, go
ahead. Well, I was going to say Boston also hit 23. So, I mean, it's a lot. Yeah. Let's move on to Golden State and Dallas. Let's talk more defense. I am here for y'all today. Let's talk Kevon Looney.
Yes, let's do
it. Oh, no. Go do the thing. I forgot. I got excited.
I mean, Golden State won by a lot of points in game one. No, 112-87 victory in game one. Dallas could not make any threes, but a portion of that is because of the multiple things that Golden State did defensively. But we can't start with Kevon Looney because that man was working on the defensive end.
I thought Kevon Looney was incredible with his effort. And I came into this series questioning what Golden State would do defensively, questioning the Warriors' small lineup, questioning if Looney could stay on the floor, considering what we'd seen happen to Rudy Gobert, what happened at times with DeAndre Ayton. And Looney had a great mindset. Now, the game plan was, hey, Luka comes off, you switch onto him and force him left. And that's your job. Mm-hmm. Help's coming. If and when he goes by you, help will be there. But you just make sure you stay up and force him left. And that was very interesting to me. Like, it's interesting to see the evolution of how teams are trying to kind of cover it. And in essence, it doesn't allow Luka to really lead the dance. Now, he could still do the crossovers and the fakes to get to the top foot or make you move. But if Looney's going to be that locked in to just keep him on the side and say, no, you can only go left, it changes the math a little bit. The other thing I had outside of Looney was just the Draymond factor, man. He just makes such a big difference. He made so many great defensive plays. It's absurd what he does defensively. We're spoiled in this conference finals. I know it's a lot of blowouts right now, but if you enjoy basketball, please watch Bam defensively, Jimmy defensively, Marcus Smart defensively, Draymond Green defensively. The decision to put him on Jalen Brunson threw me for a loop.
I didn't see it.
But if you think back, we talked about this at times. Draymond guarding Chris Paul turns his screens into a switch. This is a little bit different in this series because Brunson's so important to the Dallas Mavericks attack. But it does a couple things if you put Draymond on Brunson. One, his one-on-one attacks are a lot different.
Mm-hmm.
So you saw Draymond playing off him a little bit, sitting on the drive, trying to contest. But it's not going to force help. That's key. Number two, it kind of helps Steph Curry if Jalen Brunson tries to attack him. Because Draymond is so good at navigating screens that Steph doesn't have to show as long. Doesn't have to, you know, really stretch out so the recovery isn't as hard. So that also takes it off the table. So I was intrigued by those two things.
And on that front, like, there was one early in the first quarter where Luka kind of went after Steph. He tried to hedge and recover down the long. He was able to drive, get inside position on Andrew Wiggins, got an and one there. Outside of that, Steph pretty much nailed the hedges. And Steph defensively, period, throughout this postseason has been pretty darn good. I think he deserves his flowers for the work that he's put in on that end of the floor. I'm with you. Like, Draymond and Kevon Looney deserve the game balls for what they were able to do defensively. Draymond flying halfway across the court to block a corner three. This, like, it's just wild what he's able to do and the amount of ground that he's able to cover. And so I was really impressed with what he was able to do. You already hit it on the head with Kevon Looney forcing Luka left. Like, I want to see how Dallas counters that. Because, again, like, Luka can beat Kevon Looney left. Like, he's Luka. But, like, if you're able to basically limit the type of reads that Luka can make with the defensive personnel and the IQ that Golden State has, like, they're able to navigate that. And once you compound that with Draymond on Jalen Brunson, that puts a lot of stress on hoping for a miscue elsewhere, and now it's Reggie Bullock has to make a play and do something. Dorian Finney-Smith has to attack a closeout against someone. And that's a tough diet to live on against this team. So I wonder if they eventually, like, flip where they're setting the screens for Luka to see if they can, maybe we see more stuff on the middle of the floor so you have more room to kind of snake it and go.
I would assume less stuff on the side. I would assume try and get him in the middle of the floor. And I think there was a couple times, I want to say, before the game really got out of hand where they would switch Looney and then Luka would move towards the middle of the floor and there'd be another screen. Mm-hmm. So, okay, this is cool that you switched on to me. Now you have to navigate a screen. Now, how they kind of can manipulate that or try to is going to be interesting. Looney fought over on the one I can remember. So that'll be interesting. When I go back to the Draymond factor, the tough part is, yeah, he's on Brunson, but also as the game goes on, he's on different people. So we saw him spells on DFS, where he's now really helping. We saw him on Luka to start a possession, where now the screen is a switch. We saw him guard Josh Green. Guard. Sorry, buddy.
This can't be a Josh Green series.
It can't be a Let Draymond Roam series.
Yeah.
But yeah, that the Warriors defense held up in a way that I wasn't necessarily anticipating. I think having the zone to try and break rhythm was key. And then also just their mindset. They had a stronger mindset to stop dribble penetration. Now, what's interesting is, what does this look like when Dallas makes shots? Because the template is still there. They were able to create looks, which is important. That's half the battle. But like we talked about in the build-up to this series, it only takes one thing to come off the table for Dallas. Now, a couple came off in this game, but if the shooting's not there, it's tough. Brunson Dinwiddie not there, it's tough. Defense struggling, it's tough. So Dallas just has to get enough back on the table to make this back into a dogfight. The other thing is, I know I'm chatty patty tonight. Sorry, guys.
No, spit truth.
Golden State hit the right notes offensively. And that was important. Because half of what Dallas does is their defense basically gets you in the mud. And now you're playing a different game than you anticipated. And Golden State didn't necessarily go there. Even when Steph and Klay weren't hitting shots, their blend was just so different for Dallas because they don't stop. In theory, when they're humming, when they got it going right. It's not just the action that you're defending. Against Utah, it was, we can defend the action, but we can take away your pick and roll. Now what? Phoenix, we can defend your actions. We can bother Chris Paul and pick and roll. We can put two on Devin Booker. Now what? Golden State, yeah, sure, you're putting two on the ball and get Steph Curry. The ball moves. Now there's a cut. Oops. Those kind of plays where Golden State sustains that pressure. Now it's on Golden State to keep that up for three more games at least, as far as winning wise. Because if they go to turnovers, different conversation. If they bog down, different conversation. So I thought those were the two things. I thought Golden State just did the things they needed to do to say, hey, when we're right, we're here.
To the help point is, I guess, a comment and a question. Like, one, Golden State was really locked in. Like, Luka did try to go with Kevon Looney. We already talked about, well, you talked about the way that he was shading him and the help that came beyond that. You talked about the Draymond factor. Not much Maxi Kleber in game one because of foul trouble. And so if he's able to stay out of foul trouble in game two, like, how much does that shift Dallas' help when they kind of go to their more spacey units? I just want to see, I guess, just structurally what that looks like, because we didn't really get a deep look at it because of the foul trouble.
No, the interesting part is I feel like the answer to that question comes once Dallas makes some more shots, if that makes sense. Like, I know that's tacky to say, but they have to make Golden State blink a little bit, because even going back to that game one, if you looked at when Brunson and Dinwiddie went to their post-ups, Golden State was helping. Darn near doubling at times. Even with Reggie Bullock, one pass away. Bullock, I said it right.
There you go.
Okay, I don't need him to go coach Michael Malone on me.
Fair.
I don't need that. So it's more so like, what does it look like when they're knocking those shots down when the Warriors are in rotation?
All right, I'm with you. Actually, I wanted to go to State front. Talking about some of the shooters out there. Our good friend Dave Burt did not have a great time in his minutes. Is there a matchup for him that he can hold water on? Because I think they're going to need the three or four threes from him to kind of make this template work.
It's all going to be about when he comes in the game, honestly, and who he can hold up water against. It sounds wild. No, I don't want to say that out loud.
Well, now you have to say it out loud.
I know. It's not my contract. But it's like, what is it, Jordan Poole that's just going to play him off the court? Like, I don't know. It's he's got to hope he can survive out there, man.
Yeah, the game just snowballs so quickly in game one. It's like the first quarter happens, and again, Dallas is missing just about every three that they take, but the process seemed fine. And even with what Golden State was trying to do defensively, shading Luka a certain way, you had the Draymond matchup, you had help coming in certain ways, they were cheating over sometimes. Like, they were still able to generate good stuff. Once you got later in the first, it felt like Dallas was getting a little deeper in the clock. But process-wise, they were fine in quarter one, and then it fell apart. So now I never know how much stock to take into game one's period. But the way that that game shifted, and also just the foul trouble with Maxi Kleber that just kind of throws Dallas's best look off the table almost immediately, and them going deeper into the bench again, like Josh Green minutes in this series, I don't see how he sees the floor, much less seeing the floor while Draymond's also on the floor, because you are just empowering Golden State's best defender to do whatever he wants to do. And we talked about it during the Utah series. Like, Josh Green has not proven that he can make enough shots to make you think. He doesn't give you real juice as a roller yet. And he's not doing much off the bounce yet. So it's very much just defense and activity. And, like, who's his best offensive matchup? Like, it's probably, that might be Clay or Jordan Poole. And I think they would pretty much feel comfortable with that. And once you factor in the kind of movement stuff that Golden State gets into, like, that's just a lot for him to track. And so, like, I think for me in game two, like, my biggest thing is I just want to see Maxi Kleber on the floor, which is probably an odd thing to hear. But, like, I just want to see what that looks like. Can Dallas make shots? Because none of this matters if they can't. But also, like, just can they force Golden State's defense into rotation? Because it felt like Golden State was a moving target defensively. Like, they had a bunch of help points. Dallas wasn't making shots. And then on top of that, they're throwing in different scheme things too. So then Dallas had a whole nother layer of things to try to figure out. And by that time, Golden State's getting out on the other end and the game's going out of hand. So I just kind of want to see where it goes in game two.
You're big on the Mad Max train. I mean, Dallas was down single digits, shooting 31% after one half. And it felt the most blendy that we've seen early in the series with an attempt to get Dinwiddie and Brunson going. And so it's going to be interesting to see the adjustments because, I mean, we've seen what Dallas does once they find something and the pressure that creates and what they can sustain offensively. So they're going to keep it into a dogfight. They just got to make the adjustment defensively. Try and get Golden State into the mud and then find the pressure points offensively. Because if you can now, they're going to continue to hammer Curry and Poole. And the show and recovery was there. They're going to keep putting you in it. So that has to hold up. Looney has to continue to do this. And there's film of what he did.
Yeah, I'll take it.
So there's elements there for Dallas. I mean, I thought they played hard. It just, Golden State was a monster.
And to your point, like, especially with the show and recovery, like, that's a taxing style. And so I think even with Dallas losing this game, just getting those reps can kind of serve as some body blows that kind of add up over the course of a series. And so if you get that plus the shot making improves moving forward, like, I think this is going to be a long series. Like, even with the blowout in game one, I haven't been moved off of that. And so I guess from there, like, we'll just have to see. If I can ask you a quick Jalen Brunson question. With Draymond Green getting the matchup in game one, I would assume he gets it in game two. How do you loosen the shackles of Jalen Brunson?
Let him attack the Looney matchup. Let him keep attacking Curry. Try and get him loose. Maybe try and get him on some handoffs. I mean, Draymond's moving, but try and get him some switches, some other matchups, pulls on the court, put him on in action against him. Just make the minutes where he might have a chance to get loose count.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think letting him just being a spot-up guy is going to do it this series if the matchups continue the way they were.
Yeah, I got you. Because, like, in a vacuum, you would think Brunson one pass away is a good thing. But, like, if you're trying to set up a Luka pick and roll and Draymond's one pass, I mean, Draymond's at the nail, then what does that do? Like, if Looney's already forcing you left and now you got Draymond above the break, even if you do attack Looney's top foot, like you mentioned earlier, then you're driving into a digging Draymond. That's not what you want if you're Dallas. So I'm with you moving around the chessboard, trying to get some different actions to get them going. Trying to think. Quick shout out to Andrew Wiggins for his defense on Luka Doncic when he had the matchup. And just finding things offensively with cuts, with shots, with drives. Really impressed with the effort that he put forth in game one. I actually just kind of go to your overarching point. Like, the defense for Golden State in general was really good. And I shouted out Steph to kick off the segment. You've talked about Draymond. We've talked about Looney. Wiggins did the job. Dallas has his work cut out for him.
Yeah. And you got to credit Golden State for having the mindset. It's clear they're saying, hey, we're going to try and make it as tough as we can on Luka, but y'all can't get it going. It's going to be on Dallas to keeping the pressure on, keep forcing and creating open looks and trying to find a way. But they were a machine. It didn't look the same as far as dribble penetration went from the Memphis series to this series. Mm-hmm. And that's a credit to Golden State.
There you go. I am good. If you are good, we can close this out.
Oh, man, you just turned the lights off on me?
But
no, at least, I mean, at least if you go to the club or the bar, they start playing like a slow song and turn the lights on. This man said, yo, I'm good. I'm good. Jeez Louise.
No, jeez Louise. Did you have another takeaway?
Nah, man, I think I emptied it out. Tried to make some really good points, man. Just trying to be here. Just trying to do what I can, man.
The hashtag carry job. I respect it. Yeah, man, you killed it. What do you mean?
All right, man.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you have not already. We're on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. If you are on Twitter and have the capabilities for it, because I know they're still rolling out the feature on the app, please join the Dunker Spot community. We are having fun in there. Plenty of discussions. We're also hosting watch parties. So get in there if you haven't already. You can find me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can find Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Nikaias declined to talk about Caleb McBride's return to Las Vegas.